For several years, our family lived in a little town in Delaware called Lewis. Lewis, Delaware is right on the peninsula of a channel that goes up to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the Atlantic Ocean. It's a remarkable little town, Lewis, Delaware. It's very old. It, in fact, is an old fishing village that grew into a town. And we enjoyed living there for, like I said, about 6 or 7 years. We began a family summer tradition of going downtown to King's Homemade Ice Cream Shop. No relation, I assume. Who knows, right? But King's ice cream was so good. It was homemade. And in the summertime, that area of the Atlantic coast is a little humid and warm. And it was such a wonderful treat to go down to King's ice cream store. And in fact, it got to the point both of my sons would say, "Dad, it's time to go to King's." And so this became our Friday evening tradition. It was after dinner, we would run down to King's ice cream store and get a couple of scoops of ice cream and a sugar cone. And then we would walk across the street and we would walk through the graveyard. Now you're probably thinking, man, is he crazy? But I thought this would be a good object lesson for my sons to walk through the old graveyard in Lewis, Delaware. Because most of those old gravestones were just slate that had names and dates inscribed on them. Many of them by hand. Some of those graves were almost 200 years old. And the remarkable thing was there were a lot of captains there of boats that went fishing out of Delaware, particularly Lewis, Delaware. And so you would see a larger slate stone and it said Captain so-and-so and the date of his birth, the dash and the date of his death. And then right next to his was a smaller gravestone, and that was Mrs. Captain. Same last name. And then next to that was a maybe smaller gravestone, and that was another person with the same family name. And I remember distinctly there was one family all buried side by side, and the gravestones got smaller and smaller as they went down to the youngest. Child mortality was pretty high in those days, and oftentimes children lived to be 1, 2, 3, 5 years of age. And you can see these kind of decreasing stair steps of gravestones in the yard. And I thought this graveyard tour that we took with the ice creams each week would, as I said, be a lesson to my sons about how short life is and about the reality of life. Along the coastline are many beautiful Victorian homes in Lewis, Delaware. And on the top of these beautiful Victorian homes are what they call widow's walks. And these are little banisters up on a flat section of the roof that the widows of the captains, or before they were widows, the wives of the captains, would walk along those walks and look for their husbands to return from the sea. That's why they called them widow's walks, because oftentimes their husbands would not return from the sea. It was a rough life, I guess, in a fishing village like Lewis, Delaware. But I think one of the great lessons that I tried to teach my sons was when we're gone from this life, sometimes all that remains is the dash. That's all people will remember. As we walked through those graveyards, we looked at those very old stones, and we saw this was a captain of a sailing vessel, a fishing boat, and all that was left was the date of his birth, a dash, that represented 50, 60, 70, 80 years of life, and then the date of his death. How sad it is that in some cases, the only thing remaining from a person's life, a life of living, a family, children, work, is a dash. It seemed insufficient to express a lifetime of achievement. When we moved from Delaware, we moved to Boston, Massachusetts. And we soon discovered that south of Boston, a little town of Rhode Island, a little town of rather Newport, Rhode Island, there was a graveyard. And in that graveyard was a number of early Sabbatarians. In fact, the first Sabbatarians in America came to Newport, Rhode Island. His name was Stephen Mumford. And Stephen Mumford brought with him his son, Stephen Mumford, another Stephen. And they were importers. And they imported goods from England, where they were from. And when Stephen Mumford, the father, was in England, he became a member of the Church of God, the Bell Lane Church, to be exact, in London. And he sailed across the Atlantic, and he settled in Newport, Rhode Island. And from there, he ran this import-export business, exporting American goods back to England and importing fine English ware and goods back to the new colonies. There was no one else who kept the Sabbath. So he and his family attended the first Baptist church in America. They kept the Sabbath, and on Sundays they went to the Baptist church for inspiration. That went on for 7 years, and finally, after about 7 years, a total of seven people became convicted of the Sabbath, and they met in Stephen Mumford's home on the Sabbath and the Baptist church on Sunday. But the Baptist pastor got upset because their little group seemed to be growing. So he asked all of them to leave. So they started the first Sabbatarian church in America, seven of them. If you go in that graveyard in Newport, Rhode Island, you can find the gravestones of all seven. It's really kind of interesting. One of the most interesting is the gravestone of the bachelor in the church. Because of those seven members, it created, it represented a demographic of God's church today. There was a married couple. There was a father and a son. There was a family, Stephen Mumford with his children. There was a widow. There was a single woman and a bachelor. Among seven people, the demographics of the church was covered when it first started. But finding that bachelor's gravestone in the graveyard was very interesting because it was more complete than any other. All the other gravestones we encountered, guess what, just had the dash to represent a life. But his gravestone was a little different. On his gravestone, it said, "Here lies Roger Baster," that was his name, Roger Baster, and it said block maker, listed his profession. He was a block maker for the shipping industry. He made those blocks, you know, that they use for levers to bring goods on and off ships. He was a block maker. It says, "Here lies Roger Baster, block maker, bachelor," something he was proud of, I guess, "and founding member of the first Sabbatarian church in America." So when you read his gravestone, it seemed to capsulize something much more than just the dash. That gravestone was hand-carved, and some speculate, nobody knows, but some speculate perhaps by Roger Baster himself, because he wanted his gravestone to say something about his life. And after I saw that, I thought, that's a good idea. You know, some people endeavor to be so famous that they write, people that come later write books about them. So we know what the dash represents. But for most of us, nobody's going to come along and say, "Oh yeah, Dave Register, I'm going to write a biography about him." You know, I don't have any illusions of grandeur. I don't think anybody's going to do that. Probably for most of us, you know, some writer's not going to come along and write our story. But we all have stories, don't we? And unfortunately, after we're gone, most of those stories won't be told, except maybe in anecdotal meetings of the family where they'll say, "Oh yeah, I remember old Dave, you know, he used to do this, or he used to do that," like we do today about our long-lost relatives, right? And pretty soon those stories fade away. And as I say, 200 or 300 years later, the only thing that represents our lifetime is a dash. You know, I think one of the wisest men who ever lived, Solomon, wrote about what I'm talking about. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, I'd like to begin reading in verse 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 1. I've been thinking a lot about life and death lately, as you probably have. Of course, we have lost a couple of members of recent date, and with the passing of Bonnie and now Abe, and I know some, a couple of longtime church deacons died down in the Central Valley area in the last few months. And frankly, as God's church gets older and older, there will be more of us. I mean, we know that. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 7, chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment. To leave a good name, to leave a good reputation, the writer is saying it's better than, you know, a nice, hot Turkish bath and a good Turkish towel rub. Linda tried to get me to take one of those when I was over there. I said, no thanks. I'm not interested. And the day of death than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. One day I recall that I was getting ready to go to a funeral, and I was eating a bite of breakfast before I left. I had miles to travel to this particular funeral, and I was going by myself. And my son got up and was getting ready to go to class. He was at university at that time and living at home. And he looked at me and he said, where are you going? Because I normally didn't dress in a suit and a tie on a weekday that early in the morning. He said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to a funeral. And he went, ooh, bummer. And I said, it's better than going to a party. He said, what? What are you talking about, Dad? And I quoted this scripture. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Why would the wise write this proverb? Let's read on. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. And the living will take it to heart. Sometimes you and I avoid the subject of death, don't we? Particularly in the American culture, we don't like to talk about it. There are other cultures that talk about it a lot. I found out after I married Linda, whose mom is Japanese, that the Japanese like to talk about it all the time. Every time Linda's mom, you know, got a sore throat, got a little sore, a little complaint, a little problem, stayed in bed half a day, thought she might die, she'd, oh, Linda, come in here. Get out a pencil and a piece of paper. I want you to write down where I want all of my goods to go, you know, after I die. That's not what she sounds like, but I thought I'd just get out of voice there a little bit. She had this morbid fixation with death. And then we visited some relatives in Japan a few years ago, and I realized they all feel that way. They all don't, you know, they love to talk about death. But we Americans, we hate to talk about death, don't we? We just don't want to talk about it. We'd rather go to a party. Like my college-age son. But it says here, for that is the end of all men. And the living will take it to heart. What lesson is there to learn in the shadow of death? What lesson is to be learned? Sorrow is better than laughter. For by a sad countenance, the heart is made better. What really counts sometimes is made better by reflecting on such a serious topic. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Some wisdom can be gained by thinking about the shadow of death. But the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. How long does the joy of a party last? Basically, when the hangover's finished. Right? It's basically what I explained to my son. That's why the writer of these wise and pithy sayings said, better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Let's read more of this wise men's proverbs about life and death. Sometimes, as I said, only in the shadow of death do we become forced, if you will, to think about these topics. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 3. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. You know, I don't care how important we think we are, how smart we think we are, how wise, how talented, how skilled, how valuable we might be to our family, our organization, none of us are exempt from death. And it's amazing, even the greatest of human beings, the most skilled, the most talented, the most influential, who die, an amazing thing happens. Life continues. The world continues. The earth continues. Society continues. One of the things that really amazes me is, as I've had opportunity to visit some of these ancient civilizations, whether you're looking at the ancient Greek Empire, you can look at these cities today, and as I said, most of them are just piles of rubble. They're just big piles of rock now. At one time, Alexander the Great made a great name for himself because he took his dad's catapult, a new implement of war, and he went through all of Asia Minor and countered and conquered all of those cities in less than 3 years. That's how he became famous. Before, the method of conquering a big walled city was to surround it by your soldiers, cut off its supply of food and water, and just wait for them to give up. Because eventually they'd run out of food and water inside the walls, and they'd give up. Sometime a well-fortified, well-equipped city would last, especially if it had springs inside and they had a lot of food stores. They could last up to 7-8 years. So the army would just camp there, and they'd wait 7-8 years. And if no other ally or other army came to defeat the one surrounding the city, they'd eventually give up, they'd surrender, and the army would take over. That's how they conquered cities before the time of Philip, Alexander's father. But Philip developed something called a catapult. It was a new weapon. And he perfected this with animal sinews to the point that he could, with his catapults, he could hurl a rock the size of a Volkswagen about 300 yards pretty effectively. And his army, the Greek army, no longer had to park outside the city and wait till the city surrendered. They'd just take their catapults, line them up in front of the gates of the city, and start hurling these big rocks until it blew out the doors, and their soldiers would rush in. That's how Alexander the Great could conquer 30-some major towns across Asia Minor and march all across Asia Minor and into what had been the old Persian Empire in less than 3 years. That's why he was a world conqueror, because he had a new weapon. And yet you go there today and you say, oh, wow, Alexander the Great. You know, he died in his 30s. what's left of Alexander the Great's empire. What happened to the great Greek empire? Well, along came the Romans. They too had perfected the art of war and the art of using horsemen and the art, more effectively, of using soldiers who could use the sword. The art of not only catapults, but great Trojan horses and other implements of war that they had developed and they had borrowed from the Greeks and other people. And their masses and their money eventually overran the Greeks, conquered all the Greeks. They took over some of those Greek cities. They built their own cities. And you go there today, what's left of the Roman Empire? Piles of rubble, basically. Some reconstituted pillars and towns and rocks that you can go view. It's pretty interesting historically, but what's left of the great Roman Empire? If you go to Italy today and you ask them, what happened to the great Roman Empire? You know, well, we're still great. Just about bankrupt, but we're still great. Italy has a number of wonderful things. When you visit Egypt, it's fascinating. What's left of the great Egyptian empire that ruled the world? What's left? What's left of the great Ottoman Empire that ruled the world for 700 years? What's left? I have to ask myself, what's going to be left of the American society? Verse 4, one generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Life is pretty temporary, and the writer knew that. I'd like to ask the question, what did that dash represent in the lives of those resting in their graves? Because there's more to it than just a dash. Let's go to chapter 2 and verse 17. Chapter 2 and verse 17. The conclusion of the wise man was, therefore I hated life. I grew to hate life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me. For all is vanity and grasping for wind. He says, I worked hard, I tried, but it was like reaching out and trying to grab something firm from the air. Try that sometime, you know. That's the poetic gesture he's talking about. It's like grasping for wind. There's nothing out there after a while. Then I hated my labor in which I had toiled under the sun because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Have you ever seen that bumper sticker that says, let's see exactly what does it say. It's not coming to my mind at the moment. It's not in my notes, obviously. But it says something like, the guy who collects more stuff wins at the end, or something like that. What's that? Yeah, the more toys you have, the more you're a winner or whatever. It just, at the end of your life, what does it count? You can't take it with you. The Egyptian pharaohs tried to do that. And then the generations that came along after just robbed all those precious things they had in their tombs with them that they were going to enjoy in the next life. Let's continue on in verse 21. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Some people have accomplished quite a bit. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it and doesn't appreciate it largely. How often do we hear stories about children who receive an inheritance? Paris Hilton, as an example, case in point. She's done a great deal with the work of her grandfather and father, hasn't she? I jest, of course. This is also vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all of his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun. For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest, because we're always concerned and worried and having anxiety about tomorrow and the plans for tomorrow. This also is vanity, or the grasping after wind. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat, drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Ah, there may be a lesson in all this that we learn in the shadow of death as we think about it. This also I saw was from the hand of God. God created man to be temporary and for all of us to die. And nobody's going to beat it. All the cryogenics, all the scientists who think they can somehow bring us back to life or make us live as long as we want through genetic engineering, it ain't going to happen. Sorry if you invested in that industry. Let's go to chapter 5, Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. You know, as you're turning there, I think of Bonnie, who was a wife and a mother, a social worker. You know, she lived to help other people. That work was good while it lasted, but it's gone now, right? Because she's gone now. You think about Abe Sanchez, you know, he was a patriarch and a leader of his family. He was a giver. He's one of the best chefs I ever knew. The Feast of Tabernacles, he made some of the very best tri-tip that I've tasted. He was a good cook. I think he passed that on to his next generation, who say they can barbecue as well, which I'm very thankful for. But the point I'm trying to make is that the life even that we have today, even though we do good things with it and we make progress and we produce things, is just temporary, isn't it? It's temporary. All that we do is temporary. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. You ever notice that about people? The rich get richer. You ever heard that expression? Certainly applies in our culture. Nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is a bottomless pit, so much hot air. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Talking about inflation. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep, because rich people are always worried. We've all heard the stories about rich people like J. Paul Getty, who had to install a payphone in his house because people would come to his home and use his telephone to make long-distance calls. You might think that's pretty petty, isn't it? It was pretty Getty at the time. Sorry. But the more you have, the more anxiety it adds, doesn't it? My small retirement savings account, you know, I invested it in the stock market and in as varied things as I could, but I found myself, you know, getting up in the morning and checking, where's the Dow Jones going today? Woo-hee! Up and down, up and down. I have a little better peace of mind because somebody said, David, your age, you should put it in an interest-bearing account. I said, there's no such thing anymore, is there? 0.5%, 1%, or whatever it is. At least I sleep better at night. Verse 13, there is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return. As much as we collect in this life, we'll take nothing with us. In case you had any doubt about that. And sometimes in the shadow of death, we're reminded of that. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for this wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here's what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for that is his heritage. God wants us to enjoy life. But you know, as he says here, all the anger, all the anxiety, all the little pent-up frustrations we hold near and dear, those melt away when we die too. So why carry them around? His conclusion was, enjoy life while you have the opportunity, because it won't last but 70 years at most, or a lifetime, whatever that lifetime is, according to God's will. We realize that God indeed is in charge. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Ecclesiastes 9, beginning to read in verse 2, Ecclesiastes 9, 2. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean. The good, bad, and the ugly, as they say, all die. To him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice, as is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun. And one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to be dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. It's kind of a rough saying, isn't it? But why did he write, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting? Because it gives us an opportunity to focus on what really counts in life, doesn't it? Verse 5, for the living know that they will die. Sometimes we don't like to talk about it. We don't like to admit it. We don't like to face death, so we avoid it. But the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. And how soon it is. When you go to those old graveyards and you look at some of those stones, as I did in Boston, I went to that old graveyard on Beacon Hill where some of the forefathers of American settlers were buried. And you know what's happened over the years to those old slate stones? The weather has come, washed against them, and now you can't even read the names. We don't know who's buried there. It's just a slate stone in a graveyard. The names, the dates, and the dash have long been forgotten. The memory of them is forgotten, as it says in the latter part of verse 5. Verse 6 now, chapter 9, also their love, their hatred, and their envy is now gone. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. So go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with a wife You love all the days of your vain life, it is your temporary life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do it with your might. For there is no longer, or there is rather no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Basically, he's saying, enjoy life. Live it to the full. Because it's all going to fade away someday. It's temporary. Except one part. And we're getting to that in the book of Ecclesiastes. Let's go to chapter 12 and verse 7. Chapter 12 and verse 7. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it, awaiting the resurrection, I might add. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. It's all temporary. It's all just striving after wind in the end. Verse 13 now, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. What will last from this life? The only thing that will last is our relationship with God. That's it. Our relationship with God. The conclusion of the whole matter is, fear God, keep his commandments, for this is man's all. When the chips are down and it's ready to put the dash between the two dates, for God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. In the end, the only thing that really lasts and is important is the spiritual character that we as human beings have to build on this earth. All the rest of it is so temporary, as one realizes as we stand in the shadow of death. We realize how short life is, how temporary it is. The Bible compares it to a blade of grass, a flower that comes and goes. Doesn't last very long, does it? Let's go back to Psalms. Chapter 90, Psalms 90. In Psalms 90, it says this is the prayer of Moses. I don't know if it's a song that was preserved at this time from Moses or not, but it's kind of interesting, wise psalm that talks about some of the same subject matter that we've been covering in Ecclesiastes. Verse 1, Psalms 90, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. The only thing that lasts is God. Even the creation, as he prophesied, that he made is temporary. You know, when I looked at some of those ancient cities built on a hill and built on a harbor, because it was water that preserved them, it was fishing, it was transportation that preserved those villages. Over the years, sometimes decades, sometimes centuries, those rivers built up that silt and made those cities sterile. Even the earth itself changed. He says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Only God is permanent. You turn man to destruction, and you say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. The Bible says 1,000 years is like a day with God. That means 50 years is like 1 hour and 5 minutes with God. 75 years is less than 2 hours in God's time. 75 years seems like such a long time to us, but not to God. What should death teach us? Well, let's read on. You turn man to destruction. And you say, return, O children of men, verse 4. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night, you carry them away like a flood. They are like sheep, asleep rather, in the morning. They are like grass, which grows up in the morning. It flourishes and grows up. In the evening, it's cut down and withers. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh, just, and it's gone, a breath of air. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80, yet they boast in only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom by understanding what really counts. What really counts is our relationship with God and the spiritual growth that he affords us. Let's go to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 6. 2 Corinthians 4, 6. Paul broaches this topic of the temporary nature of life. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6. We read, for it is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. What really counts most in our life? Do we count it to be the knowledge of God? The knowledge of his truth that he's given us? Is it his spirit that we possess? Or is it the things we possess? Is it the human relationships that we have? What's most important to us? It's only at times when we stand in the shadow of death that we think about such important issues. Notice verse 7, but we have this treasure, that is the truth of God, the Spirit of God, in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. We are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We always ask the questions, why? Why now? Why her? Why him? Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested through our body. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus who may be manifested in our mortal flesh, so then death is working in us, but life in you. Death is always working in the carnal body. One man once said, you know, from the moment you're born, you start dying. You know, the human flesh just begins then the process of dying. So then death is working in us, verse 12, but life, through the power of God's Spirit and our relationship with God inside of us, and since we have the same spirit of faith according to what is written, I believed and therefore I spoke, we also believe that therefore and therefore speak, knowing that he who raised up our Lord Jesus will also raise us up with Jesus and will present us with you. That's what should be most important in the mind of a Christian, is the resurrection. And when we think of our friends who have passed, like Bonnie and Abe and others that we could name, I often think that their struggle is over. But we have yet to live and continue in our lives, don't we? Verse 15, for all things are for your sakes, and that grace, having spread through the many, may cause thanksgiving to abound to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. The important part of us, the inside, the spiritual part, is growing even through these experiences. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, we look rather at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. God asks us to number our days. Let's go to chapter 5 and verse 8. We are confident, he writes, 2 Corinthians 5, 8, we are confident, yes, well pleased rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Therefore, we make it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to him. That's what really counts, or what our actions, what we do, what we say, is it pleasing to God? For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. In chapter 3, in verse 9, actually 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 9, in Paul's first letter, 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 9, for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. And what God is building in us is not the physical. That's not what's so important, because in a moment, that can be gone. Everything we've collected, all the progress we've made, all the achievement we've made, all the years we've put in, it's gone in an instant, isn't it? When we die, what really counts? According to the grace of God, which was given to me, in verse 10, as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, another builds on it, but let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on this foundation, it is with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw. He's talking about the value of our spiritual growth. Each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. What really counts is the spiritual work we do here on earth. Let's go to Ephesians 5. I'd like to end here, Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5 and verse 14. Brethren, in the shadow of death, let's learn to number our days. That means to think about what's really important. I know it's not very popular and it's not always very pleasant to think about death. But sometimes we're forced to do it, aren't we? And the Bible says very clearly, okay, that day has arrived. Now I want you to think about it. Think about life and death and what really counts. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 14. Therefore, he says, awake, you who sleep. Arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time spiritually, because the days are evil. They're also short, I might add. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Strive to achieve the will of God. Understand that it is the will of God when someone dies. It's not just happenstance for someone who is called by God, who is God's field, God's workman, as it says, God's work. He's called us. He has a vested interest in all of us developing for that position he talked about in his kingdom. He goes on, do not be drunk with wine in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Now's the time for us to encourage one another. It's the time for us to rally around those who are sorrowing. It's a time to reflect on our own humanity and our own mortality. Singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Giving thanks always for all things. Sometimes that's hard to do in the shadow of death. But we can be thankful for the accomplishments those who have died have made. We can be thankful for their lives. We can be thankful that God has spared them from the evil that could come. He knows best. Giving thanks always, verse 20, for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Unless Christ returns in our lifetime, we will all die. Every one of us. Nobody's been able to escape it so far. Like Bonnie, like Abe, and so many before them. What will that dash represent in our lives? The dash between the date of our birth and the date of our death. What really will count? What really should count is the spiritual heart, the spiritual character, the spiritual mind that we develop now. What's really important? Sometimes thinking about the issues of life and death remind us about what is really important in this life.